From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The U.S. Supreme Court has a new justice. Chief Justice John Roberts administered the judicial oath of office to Amy Coney Barrett this morning, with just a week to go before the presidential election. The Republican-controlled Senate confirmed her last night in one of the fastest confirmations in history, and one that cements a 6-3 conservative majority on the court. Here to look at some of the big cases likely to land on her plate over the next couple of weeks is Dahlia Lithwick. She writes about the courts and the law for Slate and is host of the legal podcast Amicus. Dahlia, always good to speak with you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
So day one for Justice Barrett on the Supreme Court. What's ahead in the first few weeks on the job?
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty bracing beginning. In the coming weeks, the court's going to hear a big, big case out of Philadelphia about whether religious foster care agencies can refuse to place kids with same-sex foster parents and accept taxpayer money. They're going to hear a big, big challenge, as probably people know if they've been listening to the hearings, I think, signaling the end of the Affordable Care Act if the Trump administration prevails. And as soon as this Friday, even, the court's going to be deciding whether they're going to take up a big pre-viability abortion ban out of Mississippi that's directly in collision with Roe. So she's going to hit the ground running.
Yeah, going big right away. Let's dig into a few of these. She could also hear some pretty big voting cases. Yesterday, the Supreme Court did not extend the mail-in ballot deadline in Wisconsin, but it deadlocked on a similar extension in Pennsylvania last week. What can you tell us about these election cases that I know are top of mind for many people?
You know, it's so interesting because so many of them are happening on the so-called shadow docket, which means they're not briefed or argued properly. We get these sort of late night orders and we don't know fully the reasoning. But you're certainly right. I think that in the next coming few days with Barrett on the court, we're going to re-up that Pennsylvania case that was deadlocked 4-4 last week that would have extended the counting of mail-in ballots received within 3 days of the election. The Republican Party is now saying we want you to look at that again, but we've got a Nevada suit with the Trump campaign trying to block counting of ballots in Clark County, North Carolina challenge about curing ballots, absentee ballots that arrive after Election Day, suit in Michigan seeking to block a new rule that would ban the open carry of firearms around polling places. Any one of these could explode into this year's Bush v. Gore.
Well, and you know, you mentioned health care. You said that you thought this signaled the end of the Affordable Care Act. Let's talk about that. What is this case that we're going to hear in just a couple of days before the Supreme Court?
It's a sort of super technical question, Peter. After Congress zeroed out the penalty in the Affordable Care Act, the question was whether the mandate itself is now unconstitutional. And the fancy legal word is severability. If the mandate is unconstitutional, does the entire ACA fall, like kind of like Jenga board? And the question before the court is this technical severability question. Can you zero out the mandate and the rest of the law survives? Judge Barrett gave us no hints what she thought of that, but it is a very technical question that'll have very, very significant real world consequences.
Will Democrats think the law will fall under Justice Barrett? Is it too soon to know what the next steps would be if in fact that happens?
I mean, I think it's one of the things that was really one of the high ironies of her hearings was hearing people like Lindsey Graham say, oh, that's not going to happen. That's, in other words, we had Republicans saying, oh, no, it's never going to happen, that the whole law falls. But it's important to understand the Trump administration has come in saying that this individual mandate is not severable. The whole thing has to fall. So we don't know what's going to come next. I do think that that's the reason you've just identified why Democrats made the totality of her hearing about the ACA.
Tell me more about this first abortion-related case to come before the court, and will it likely be one that would challenge Roe v. Wade?
Yeah, I mean, we actually have a whole raft of abortion challenges coming up from all sorts of different places that have percolated up from different states. The one that the court will be discussing this Friday, we'll get an announcement on Monday, is this pre-viability abortion ban that comes out of Mississippi. This one really is directly on the nose, a challenge to Roe. But the court could choose from a whole host of others. And it is hard to imagine that right before an election, the court will take up this particular ban. I think it would be such an inflammatory act right before an election that it seems to me that they may let this percolate a while longer. There's enough other hot button things that are coming up immediately.
Well, now that the confirmation is official, so many of these issues become less hypothetical and more real world. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The mayor of Philadelphia says a shooting of a black man yesterday afternoon presents difficult questions that must be answered. 27-year-old Walter Wallace Jr. was shot and killed by police after authorities say they responded to a report that Wallace was waving a knife around. His family said he was shot in front of his mother and brother. And protesters quickly took to the streets. Dozens were arrested and at least 30 police officers were hurt, according to officials. Let's bring in WHYY reporter Jimena Condi, who has been following this story in Philadelphia. And Jimena, there were bystanders there. There was a bystander video that appears to show Wallace several feet from police before he walks towards them, then backs up, then the camera turns away, and we hear the gunshots. What do we know about what happened in the minutes leading up to this shooting?
Yeah, so police say that the department received a call about a person with a weapon in West Philadelphia yesterday, shortly before 3 in the afternoon. We know that when they arrived, like you said, they found Walter Wallace Jr., who is black, with a knife. We do, through that cell phone footage, we hear officers telling Wallace, at least in one instance, to drop the knife that he's holding. And then, you know, like you said, the camera pans away for a second, and that's when you hear the officers fire their guns multiple times. According to police, Wallace was struck in the shoulder and chest, and that's when police took him to a local hospital, and he was pronounced dead shortly after 4 p.m. We don't know the names or ethnicities of the officers, and we don't know how long they've been on the force, but we do know that they were taken off street duty.
Okay. Do you know anything about the officers that were hurt? What happened and how are the officers doing right now?
Yes. So of the at least 30 officers were injured, according to the police department. Most of them were treated and released as of this morning, with the exception of one sergeant who suffered a broken leg when a pickup truck hit her. We know that these injuries took place while hundreds of people marched through West Philadelphia, and there was a bit of looting, and the situation grew tense, and that's when the injuries took place.
I see. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kinney said he spoke with the Wallace family, and the police department has launched an investigation into the shooting. What did officials say about how they would approach this investigation?
Yeah, so far we know that the internal investigation that's taking place is routine for this type of incident. Yes, Mayor Jim Kenney promised a full investigation. So did District Attorney Larry Krasner, and so did Police Commissioner Daniel Outlaw. Outlaw promised that all of residents' questions would be answered through the investigation, and she also has plans to meet with residents and Wallace's family to hear about their concerns as soon as possible.
Wallace's father told the Philadelphia Inquirer that his son dealt with mental health issues and took medication. What else do we know about Wallace?
So we actually don't know much more from that at the moment. The Wallace family hasn't been talking to reporters today. They've sort of been bombarded by national media, and so they haven't talked more about their son. One neighbor did say that Wallace only recently started to frequent the block this summer, but overall she said that He seemed like a quiet young man.
Hmm. This shooting is the latest, as we know, to spark protests after the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. It also comes right before Election Day. What are the streets like out there right now? And just thinking about the broader context of policing in Philadelphia.
Yeah, so this morning I was at one of the main business corridors where there was some looting, and for the most part, residents are outraged. Most of them have seen the video. They have questions about why police resorted to shooting Wallace so many times. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of like their biggest fear realized, in the sense that not much has changed in policing since the protests this summer. And, a lot of them are asking, but half of the police force is supposed to be trained in crisis intervention, and they're asking questions about how effective this approach is.
So much to follow here. That's WHYY reporter Ximena Condi. Thank you so much.
If the current news cycle isn't scary enough for you, we have some real-life horror stories now to help get you into the haunting season. Glenn Washington is host of my favorite podcast, Spooked, which is a collection of real people telling supernatural tales that'll freak you out any time of year. He's also the host of Snap Judgment, and he's here with us now. Glenn, welcome.
It's amazing to be here, Peter. Thank you.
And what draws a guy to do a podcast about ghosts?
Well, Peter, the very first year of Snap Judgment, the very first year when it came around Halloween time, we do a first-person storytelling show. And we thought, let's just do those stories that they think maybe they might not be believed, or for whatever reason they won't tell. Let's tell those stories the same way we tell anything else. And that podcast ended up being the most downloaded episode of the year. And really, Peter, I think, I had stories of my own that didn't make any sense to me. And I thought maybe I was the only one who had those stories. And it turned out nothing could be further from the case.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you how this applies to your own life. People who are familiar with you and your work know that you have a very interesting background. You grew up in what you've described as a religious cult. I just wonder if any of that influenced the way you see the supernatural.
It does very much. But I will say this. When I was a very, very little kid, my extended family was not in our cult. I was my grandmother's second favorite child. Mm-hmm. And at her house, she was just known in the neighborhood. People who the doctor couldn't help them, the pastor couldn't help them, their neighbor couldn't help them. And they would come to my grandmother's house. And again, I'm just a little kid, but my job was to take someone from the front porch, hand in hand, lead them through the house to the stoop where my grandmother was, where they can sit on this little wicker chair. And she would talk to them, and they would ask her for things. And the things they would ask her for are oftentimes like, my husband isn't here anymore. I think he's running around the way. What can you do? I need some help. And she might take a little bit of the hair that was brought on the brush. She'd put it in a little bit of paper. She would burn that into ash. She'd wrap that in a little bit of foil. And she'd do a little chant over it. And sometimes she'd say, put this underneath your bed. Your husband will be back in 3 days. The worst times is when she would say, no, I can't help you. And they would be begging to me, a little kid, can you say something to her? Can you ask her again? And I had to say, Granny said she couldn't help you. I'm sorry. And saying sorry to grown people, that was a thing I learned from my grandmother. I always thought, everyone had a grandmother like mine. And then I learned later on that everyone didn't.
No, sir.
But then I learned later on after that that some people did.
Yeah. you've set us up perfectly. We asked you before you came on to bring some of your favorite stories from Spooked. We're going to get our hands bloody with a few of those right now. We're going to start with Skinwalker. The guy telling this story is Lee.
Yeah.
He's 14 years old at the time, driving home late one night, when on the side of the road, something catches his attention. Let's listen.
It was tall, and it was very thin. And it had long arms, it had long legs. It had fur on its shoulder, had fur on its arms, had fur on its legs. And I see whatever this was running towards us, just running towards the truck. And I'm already going 30 miles an hour. And I see its arms swinging, these long arms and long legs taking big strides. At this point, I was speeding up. I was going to the point where I was like 65 miles an hour on a dirt washboard road. So I was fishtailing. And this thing is keeping up.
Oh, wow. I just spent a minute with goosebumps down my neck. Why do you like this one?
I like it for so many different reasons. But first of all, I think I like it because, again, you're hearing a real person tell their real story. We knew of this skinwalker phenomena that pops up in a lot of Native American cultures. And it's one of those stories where people are oftentimes reluctant to share with outsiders. Oftentimes, you feel when someone tells a story on Spooked, at the end of the process, you can see almost a burden being lifted, a weight gone from this person, because it's like the stories that you can't tell anybody else, tell us.
Well, I'm so glad you said that, because one of the reasons I think these stories are so amazing is that there's never any doubt that what these people are describing feels utterly real to them, no matter how outlandish it would sound to the rest of us.
And that's just it. You know, it's almost like you get to balance two completely opposite ideas in your head at the same time.
You know, I should have told parents, if they have kids in the room, to either turn up the volume because they're going to love this, or get them in the other room, because here's another one. This one is from The Haunting of Radio Centro. The storyteller Guillermo works at Radio Centro in Mexico City. There are rumors that the radio station is haunted, that ghosts are roaming the hallways, and one night he's hosting the station's paranormal show, Tell It Tonight, when this happens to him.
We ran some promos covering all the shows that people could listen to throughout the day. The last promo was the one for Tell It Tonight. I hit play to start the first promo, then the second.
Yo creo estaba por entrar el tercero o cuarto.
The third promo was about to play when the machine jumped. And we hear the organ, like the music from the beginning of the promo.
Las perillas se van al
máximo. Knobs went up to maximum volume, drowning everything out. I get super hot, like my temperature shot up. The audio is still loud. I turn down the speakers, I let the promo run, and when I hold onto the table to lean back and stand up to refresh myself, I start to feel very ill.
Y en ese momento,
and in that moment, I feel as if someone is leaning on my back. I feel a chest against my back and breathing right in my ear, here on my left side, I hear it. And with his hands, he started to squeeze my head.
Oof.
So I push myself up and backwards so I can free myself from this entity. I get up from the chair and I head to the double door.
Glenn, I do not like it when the ghosts start touching you. How common is that? I mean, are there any themes like that that you notice throughout these stories that you're telling?
You know, a collective theme is hard, except to say that every single culture, they have their own monsters. And those monsters always obey different rules depending on where you are. The djinn in North Africa is going to be very, very different than a ghost in Maine. But yeah, I guess there are certain things, and that these creatures are oftentimes most active in a twilight situation. And these are not creatures that run around in the bright light of day.
Hmm. Well, over the years doing this podcast, I mean, has it changed the way you see things? Like, it sounds like to me, you're a believer. You don't have to be convinced.
I don't believe anything. I don't think people are lying to me. I think we go through a huge process to kind of weed out, let's just say weed out the crazy. And the people who actually appear on Spook to tell us a story, these are credible people. These are respected people who might have had something very, very strange happen to them. I know that I've had my own experiences that I can't explain in sort of a rational NPR-ish dialogue. But
please tell me, what happened?
One of my very earliest memories was when I was asleep in bed next to my little baby brother. And we look up and we see a face floating above our bed. And we call out to it, but it doesn't answer. It just kind of looks. It's like it's curious. It's all up just looking at us. And then it vanishes. And the next morning we go down to tell our mother about it, but our mother is not downstairs. Instead, it's our grandmother. And she says, "Don't worry, babies. Don't worry. Your mama's going to be back. I'm just going to be here and watch you for a while." Well, mother doesn't come back. She doesn't come back for a little while, about a day and a half. And when she does, she's sad. She don't even look at us. And I don't understand what's going on until I'm under a stair and I hear her talking to my aunties about losing the baby. And I know then that our sibling had come back to give us his brothers a visit the same night that she was in the hospital. And I don't want to tell her that because I think that it'll make her angry and sad and scared. I think it's one of those earliest things where you know this is a secret you better keep.
Glenn Washington, you're a man who can tell a story. Thank you so much. Host of the Supernatural podcast, Spooked. You also may recognize his voice as the host of Snap Judgment. And Glenn, it may be Halloween coming up, but I listen to these stories all year long. They'll scare the pants off of you anytime. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And what do you think? Do you believe in ghosts? Have you ever been visited? Hit me up on Twitter. I'm at O'Dowd Peter.
The NYPD has vowed to beef up police presence at polling places on Election Day this year, primarily, it says, to deter voter intimidation. But in other states like New Jersey and North Carolina, election officials are taking steps to restrict officers from voting sites because some voters say the police themselves are intimidating. For more, let's bring in Sean Morales Doyle, a deputy director at the Brennan Center who focuses on voting rights and elections. Sean, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So this may seem like a very 2020 dilemma. Some people feel safe with police officers around while others do not. Can you lay out what some of the rules are, really depending on where you live?
Sure. So the laws vary across the country. There are parts of the country where police are required to be at polling places. And then there are parts of the country where the police are essentially prohibited from being at polling places unless they're called there. Right? There's nowhere where police are banned from polling places, but there are a number of states where police are not going to be sort of preemptively posted at polling places, and their job is to respond to the calls from election officials. And the idea is that elections should be run by election officials, not by law enforcement. These are not meant to be high tension situations, but rather a public opportunity for civic engagement. And in the vast majority of situations, polling places and elections go off without a hitch. You know, there are reasons for police to come occasionally. There are times when things go wrong. But that is, as I said, the rare situation.
Mm-hmm. The New York City Police Benevolent Association, which describes itself as the largest municipal police union in the world, endorsed President Trump earlier this summer. And it's the first time in decades that this organization has made a presidential endorsement. Does this complicate this latest move by the NYPD to have more officers out on Election Day?
I think that if people could be confident that police were not engaging in outwardly political behavior while doing their jobs, that whether or not their union takes a political position would be sort of beside the point. Unfortunately, there have been a couple of instances recently where police have taken outwardly political positions while on duty. I think the police forces, for what it's worth, have made clear that that's inappropriate and have said they shouldn't be doing that. But I think that, you know, it's that crossing of the line that makes people, that raises concerns for folks. And it contributes to concerns about intimidation, voter intimidation by the police, which is unfortunate.
You mentioned examples of police intimidation. There was a photo of an officer in Miami that was widely shared on social media. He was at an early voting site wearing a Trump face mask. He's now facing discipline. And of course, this is a more extreme example. But if people feel intimidated or uncomfortable with a police officer at their polling place, what can they do?
Anybody that's experiencing voter intimidation should let poll workers know, let elections officials know, and call 1-866-OUR-VOTE, the election protection hotline. And that goes for any type of intimidation, right? Some of the reasons people are calling for police to be at the polls is because of other forms of voter intimidation. And All voter intimidation is illegal. It's illegal under federal law. It's illegal under many state laws. Most of the time, we don't have an issue, and people should feel comfortable and confident going out and exercising their right to vote.
Sean Morales Doyle is a deputy director at the Brennan Center who focuses on voting rights and elections. Sean, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are closing in on the end of the month, when many people are scraping by to pay their rent and bills. Several states had moratoriums in place during the pandemic that prevent utilities from being shut off to customers who can't pay. However, many of those moratoriums are ending, leaving tens of millions of people at risk of service shutdowns in the winter months. Joining us now is Mark Wolf, Executive Director of the National Energy Assistance Directors Association. Mark, welcome back.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. So we spoke with you during the summer about people struggling to pay for air conditioning, but now we're entering the winter, and I'm sure heating is now something you're very concerned about.
Yes, it's the next bill. So what we're very concerned about is not just the cost of heating, but millions of Americans have been on moratoriums. In other words, they were able to delay payment on their cooling bills. But now those bills are continuing, and they're now having heating bills on top of that. So we're estimating that many families owe close to $800 now on their utility bills. Mm. And by the end of winter, that could rise up to $1,700. So at the end of March, since all signs point to a continuing weak economy, there could be millions of families owing more than a year's worth of energy bills.
You've been collecting data on those most impacted. How would you describe the scale?
Well, right now we think there's about $24 billion in bad debt that families haven't been able to pay. And by March, that could reach $40 billion. Mm. So if you think about that, these are families that have lost their jobs and that once the pandemic ends and they get back on their feet, they get a job again, they'll be burdened with these energy bills. We have to think through a solution so that they can get back to work and not have to worry about bills associated with the pandemic.
Let's talk a little bit about resources. So you work with state directors who are participating in the federal low-income home energy assistance program, which provides assistance to people who are struggling to pay their utility bills. How often are people tapping into this resource for help?
Well, right now we reach about 6 to 7 million families a year. And we do have money available. Congress did provide the regular appropriation for this year, and then they provided an additional $900 million through the first stimulus bill. So that will help, but it's not enough money. But we don't want to discourage people as well from applying.
Yeah, I can imagine even before the pandemic, this type of program needed more funding. But considering the state of our economy right now, how much more support do you think it needs to keep operating?
Well, we're asking for an additional $10 billion to cover the additional need. Congress, in the stimulus bill that passed the House, that didn't pass the full Congress, provided an additional $4.5 billion. And that would have helped a lot. So we're very disappointed that the stimulus bill fell apart. It didn't pass this Congress. But when you think about this, this is a problem that can be solved. It's a solvable bill. You know, there's a lot of concern about airlines. You know, airlines are struggling to pay their bills, and there was an effort to have a bailout for airlines. There was the Paycheck Protection Program that bailed out small and medium-sized businesses. This is the same thing. These are families that have bills to pay, and energy is the definable bill, and we can pay that. We can help them get back on their feet when the moratorium ends, and I think that's essential. And if you think about the Paycheck Protection Program, there's a certain irony here. That's a loan program that's going to be forgiven. Why can't we also forgive these debts? It's the same argument.
What is the risk of the administration not doing anything? I mean, we have a week to go before the election to really pass something, and it really looks as if it's becoming a narrower and narrower window. What is the risk of the administration not taking further action to help make sure people don't get their water and power shut off?
Well, the risk is that the bills will keep piling up. I mean, in many cases, the utilities are not going to shut people off. I mean, the real concern if we don't pass a stimulus bill, well, it might be almost impossible now in the last week of this Congress or during the lame duck session, is that people will keep falling behind and the utilities will start to have no choice. Utilities have talked about things like, we'll work out a repayment plan. Well, that's great if you have a job. But these families still are unemployed. They don't have a job. And so what's the choice? You let them keep building up debt. And then once they have a job, they can't ever get out of that debt. So it's a problem that we all see, Congress recognizes, but because of the inability to reach an agreement on the stimulus bill, everything's on hold.
Mark Wolf is Executive Director of the National Energy Assistance Directors Association. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we heard Mark Wolf say, millions of people are struggling to make ends meet, and Cynthia Carter of Chicago is one of them. Cynthia is currently unemployed, and while she's been able to get some help from some of the energy assistance programs we heard about earlier, right now is still a major challenge. Cynthia, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
So before this pandemic, you were juggling two jobs, helping your mother with her daycare business and working as a teacher for young children at a women's shelter. You were furloughed in July. How are you feeling about your situation right now?
When you wake up in the morning and just try not to allow the anxiety, sometimes it's still like a heaviness on your chest. So I go for walks, try to do a little exercise so, you know, stress and anxiety don't override. And just try to stay hopeful that things will eventually change. I'll eventually get on the path that I need to be on and opportunities will be available for me.
Yeah, absolutely. How much of a help has it been to get help to pay for your gas and electric bills?
Oh, man, it's been a tremendous, tremendous help, because at one point I had received a notice that the lights, you know, probably be turned off. And the gas, as you know, the weather here is getting colder and colder, so I have to turn on the heat in October.
Yeah, your landlord has also been understanding, but you haven't paid your rent since July. What's your plan for rent this month and the next?
I'm staying hopeful. I'm still waiting to receive an answer for the rent assistance program, but I know that there will be someone that God will use to help me to pull through.
This is almost a full-time job in itself, just trying to figure out how to put things all together.
Oh, absolutely. Just trying to figure out where to go from here is a challenge, because I still want to be involved with children, but I'm looking maybe if I can help the mom and the child. I do know that it has been where parents would come to me and I'm able to help them when they come to me as far as encouraging them. That's my passion. That's where I want to go. But I don't know how to get to this road or what I, you know, at this point.
How has this experience motivated your decision for who you will vote for this election?
To me, I don't care who's president, which one wins. It's the two of the lesser evil. That's how I see it. And if the person that's in there right now is not doing everything in his power to make any changes in the different crises that we're facing, you're not trying to me, you're not trying to bring unity where there's division. I know you can't control the virus, but things that are being said about no mask. I lost two of the members of our church that I knew since I was a child that helped me when I was carrying my first child that was there to help me. And now she's dead.
I'm so sorry, Cynthia.
And so to lose two sisters 2 days apart that were very close to me, and then you see people not wearing masks or not keeping social distance, and the president is, to me, is very, he's like the people that's not wearing the mask. And so, you know, that helps me to make a decision which way I'm going to vote.
Cynthia Carter is an unemployed teacher from Chicago, speaking to us about the challenges of trying to pay for her utility bills and rent during the pandemic. Cynthia, I thank you for taking the time to talk with us, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll have resources on how to apply for assistance with utility bills at hereandnow.org.
Fracking has become a big issue in the final days of the presidential race. Yesterday, President Trump was in Pennsylvania, where a fracking boom began a decade ago. He called it an issue of existential importance to the state. He also pointed to Joe Biden's comments in last week's debate, when Biden said he would, quote, transition from the oil industry.
That means no fracking, no jobs, no energy for Pennsylvania families, Texas, all the other places.
And Biden pushed back yesterday.
Let me make it clear. I'm not shutting down oil fields. I'm not eliminating fracking.
Bloomberg News energy and environment reporter Ari Natter joins us now. And Ari, do you think Biden has bungled up his message on this issue in the final days of the campaign?
Maybe a little. It was kind of a surprising admission to hear him say he would transition out the oil industry, which of course is kind of implied in his climate plan, which calls for net zero emissions by 2050. And then you kind of saw the campaign try to walk that back just a little following that, with him saying, you know, he was actually referring to transitioning out oil subsidies for the industry.
So to be clear, Biden's position is that he wants to transition away from the oil industry by 2050. That would be to renewable energy sources. And he wants to ban fracking on federal lands. Let's spend a moment there. How much fracking actually occurs on federal lands, and what state would be most affected?
Right. Well, that's interesting because not much actually occurs on federal lands. Something like 90% of the wells are on private land, which the government can't regulate without an act of Congress. New Mexico, you know, has actually a lot of fracking that occurs on federal land. I think something like 90% of the state's Permian production occurs on federal land. We've seen oil and gas companies, you're kind of racing, you know, to obtain permits and leases, you know, ahead of a potential Biden presidency. And also we've seen, you know, some of the Democratic lawmakers from that state who are locked into tight races distance themselves from Biden's remarks on the oil and gas industry, saying they support it.
And what about in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, where this is really seems to be a pretty key issue? At least the president is trying to make it a big issue. I understand that very, very little fracking happens on public land.
Right, that's right. And this is definitely a politically important issue in those key states. And what he's doing there is kind of, you know, a political messaging where he can make it seem like he's doing something on fracking, which is reviled by environmental groups and the left wing of the party, while actually, you know, keeping it going.
So do you think that Biden's position on energy and fracking makes him vulnerable there, or can people sort of understand that actually his policies might not make that much of an immediate impact in those states?
Right. Well, I think Biden's made it clear, or at least tried to, that he actually wouldn't transition out fracking, you know, nationwide. He said that repeatedly. And, you know, I think his remarks in the debate last week, you know, kind of came late in the game. I think a lot of people are kind of entrenched in their positions, and 65 million or so have already voted. You know, I really think the Trump campaign was trying to, or at least hoping that this would be like, you know, the 2016 remark where Hillary Clinton said she would put the coal industry out of business, which, of course, she later said was one of her biggest gaffes. I think Biden seems pretty safe at this point. We also have to factor in the fact that, you know, more and more voters, including Republicans, you know, want action on climate change.
Yeah. And let's talk about how he would do this if he were to become president. Would it be easy to enact a ban or a freeze as Obama did with coal leases?
There's a couple of avenues he could do it. I mean, he could just halt permitting or write drilling plans that, you know, don't call for any new drilling. But, of course, he'd have to go through a regulatory process that could be challenged in law and very likely will be. So he could do it, but it's going to be a little bit tricky, I think.
When Biden says that he wants to end subsidies for oil, what does that mean? I mean, what can you tell us about how widespread those subsidies are?
Right. So the oil industry does get, you know, billions of dollars of subsidies. I've seen estimates as high as, you know, $20 billion a year. But those are kind of baked into the tax code and are special deductions and accounting methods that, you know, aren't really very high profile as compared to, you know, the wind and solar tax credits, which have to be renewed every so often, you know, throwing them into the limelight. So, you know, the oil industry does get subsidies, but they're not really made a big deal of.
What has President Trump said his plans are for fracking?
You know, he definitely supports it. I mean, he's really campaigned on energy independence and this boom in domestic production that actually began before his presidency. But, you know, thanks in large part to fracking, which has allowed, you know, the country to tap into you know, shale formations that were previously thought impossible. I mean, Trump's position on climate has been kind of generally calling for clean air and water while, you know, touting the fact, you know, he's reducing regulations and helping business.
Yeah. That's Ari Natter, Bloomberg News energy and environment reporter. Ari, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
Arizona Democrats think they can turn the state blue in November for the first time in 24 years, but it won't come easy. That's next time on Here and Now.